Butcher 17, Evil and Suffering, Medieval and Modern.
We're continuing our discussion of evil, and we're moving into the medieval period. We're going to be looking at Maimonides' response, as well as the Zohar's, and then a later group of Jewish mystics who were associated with Isaac Luria in Sfat, Safed, in the land of Israel in the 16th century. Then finally, we'll talk about the Shoah, the Holocaust, and some religious responses to the Holocaust. As we begin to reflect philosophically about the nature of evil, Maimonides tells us, we must come to the understanding that evil is not real. Evil is only apparent. I'm not sure if Maimonides ever had to tell someone who was experiencing suffering that evil is not real, but this is what he writes. And I should say, as a biographical note, that Maimonides was no stranger to suffering. His younger brother David drowned in a ship accident, and from what the historical records indicate, Maimonides was crushed by this and didn't leave his house for a period of a year, so he was no stranger to depression. But nevertheless, Maimonides says that evil is the absence of good, that there is no reality to evil itself. Imagine a bagel. Is the hole in the bagel real, or is it just the absence of the bagel? It's the absence of the dough in that circular form that you bite into with cream cheese and lox. So just like the hole in the bagel is not real, evil is not real. It is just the absence of good. For Maimonides, as for Job, there are certain Jobian echoes here, all of God's actions are purely good for the universe as a whole, but our finite intellect is often unable to penetrate divine wisdom. I want to read to you a quote from Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed, because you'll get a feel for Maimonides' personality. Often it occurs to the imagination of the multitude that there are more evils in the world than there are good things. The reason for this whole mistake lies in the fact that this ignoramus, and those like him among the multitude, consider that which exists only with reference to a human individual. Every ignoramus imagines that all that exists, exists with a view to his individual sake. It is as if there were nothing that exists except him. And if something happens to him that is contrary to what he wishes, he makes the trenchant judgment that all that exists is an evil. However, if man considered and represented to himself that which exists and knew the smallness of his part in it, the truth would become clear and manifest to him. So Maimonides doesn't have much patience with those individuals, those ignoramuses, who understand that they are the center of the universe. Indeed, Maimonides was not anthropocentric. He did not believe that the universe was made for human beings, in this sense. We are just one part of God's creation. And once we understand the glory and magnitude of God's creation, which is why we should study Aristotelian physics, we'll understand all our small part in it. But nevertheless, Maimonides does recognize that there is suffering in the world. So how does he explain that suffering? Maimonides breaks it down into three types. There are evils that befall human beings because we are made of flesh and blood. But flesh and blood is necessary in order for there to be generation and increase, right? So there must be passing away. This, Maimonides says, is the most infrequent kind of evil. So evils that fall into this category would be something like cancer. We've got to be made of flesh and blood in order to reproduce. But if we're made of flesh and blood, then we also decrease and we die away, we pass on. This is obvious to Maimonides, but as a result of being flesh and blood, certain things can go wrong with our flesh. And more than that, we are then susceptible to earthquakes and fire and tidal waves and being victims of ship accidents on the high seas. But Maimonides says that's the most infrequent kind of evil that befalls human beings. More common are those evils that people inflict on one another. And of course, here we're talking about murder, we're talking about war, we're talking also about psychological evils or cheating. Cheating in business or cheating in marital relations, those kinds of evils as well. But according to Maimonides, the most common evils that human beings experience are self-inflicted wounds. I'm not sure if he's speaking from personal experience or not, but it's interesting to do an inventory of the evils that we've experienced and ask ourselves if most of those evils have been the result of self-inflicted wounds. For Maimonides and the Aristotelian tradition, evil is not real. Evil is only apparent. It is the absence of good. As we move on to Jewish mysticism, the mystics can't deny the reality of evil. It is too pressing to them to deny it. But nevertheless, that raises a problem. When you admit the reality of evil, does that mean that God, who is the source of all reality, is evil? Or, alternatively, if God is not the source of evil, does that mean that there's another power in the world that is the source of evil? So in a monotheistic tradition, you can't admit other independent powers that perpetrate evil in the world. That's Gnosticism, the belief in two separate deities, a god of good and a god of bad, or Zoroastrianism. These were religions that Judaism polemicized against. In Isaiah, we have the prophet saying that God created both good and bad, in contradistinction to what the prophet was, the religious culture that the prophet was living within in Persia, this idea of dualism, of two different gods, a god of good and a god of evil. So how does the Zohar do it? It is ingenious. The Zohar says that God is real, that's true, but the Zohar says that evil is real, but it's not autonomous. Evil is parasitic on human transgression. Okay, so how does this work? Adam's transgression in the Garden of Eden threw off this finely tuned symmetrical balance within the Godhead. If we think back to the Sfirot, I said that one way to picture the Sfirot is the male and female energies being in sync. Another way to imagine the Sfirot is the right side, the side of mercy, and the left side, the side of judgment, being in balance. And according to the myth of the Zohar, when that finely tuned balance of mercy and justice gets thrown off or gets thrown off kilter, justice becomes inflamed and breaks away from mercy, and evil is created. So up until that moment in the Garden of Eden, mercy and justice were in balance. They were in sync. They were finely tuned. As a result of human transgression, the aspect of divine justice was inflamed and broke off from divine mercy, and justice, and here is the psychological truth behind the myth, that justice, untempered or unbalanced by mercy, can become evil. And that's what happens in the mythological world of the Zohar. That justice untempered by mercy becomes evil. And what does it do? It creates this whole other universe of evil forces that's exactly parallel and symmetric to the forces of good. And this is called the Sitra Achra, which is Aramaic for the other side. If you think about George Lucas's Star Wars, he understood this kind of theology very well. Because Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader are not opposing autonomous forces of good and evil. They're good and evil, but they're drawing from the same force. The force is the force, but Darth Vader is the dark side of the force. This is not Gnosticism. George Lucas is not a Gnostic in this sense. So just like in Star Wars, you've got the force and the dark side, in Jewish mysticism, you've got, well, there's no name, just like the force. You've got God and godliness in the spherotic world and the Sitra Achra, or the other side. And what is so audaciously anthropocentric in this sense is that whatever human beings do, and remember, we're really not talking about human beings for the Zohar, we're talking about male mystics who are engaged in the commandments with the proper kavanah or the proper intention, whatever they do, whether it is a transgression or a commandment, they can either empower the godly forces, the good forces, or the demonic evil forces in the Sitra Achra. And then what happens is something like trickle-down economics. As a result of doing good or doing bad, it primes the pump, and it begins a process, a synergistic process, whereby by the time that good or bad act filters down through these different worlds and demons into our world, the effects are disproportionate to whatever good or bad the individual did. So that's how we can explain, or that's how the mystics in Spain could explain, the beginning of anti-Semitic riots in 1391, for instance. It must have been something that the Jews did, whether intentionally or unintentionally, because this is interesting. Transgressions don't require malicious intent, right? In American law, for the highest degree of punishment, you need mens rea, you need criminal intent. In Jewish mysticism, the Jewish mysticism of the Zohar, in order to get the full benefit of God's blessings, you need to engage in a commandment with the proper intention. But if you commit a transgression, it doesn't matter if you were intending to commit the transgression or not, or if you were intending to commit the transgression for a good reason or not. The classic example of this is nocturnal emissions. You're not intending to commit this act, but nevertheless, according to the Zohar, it unleashes all kinds of malevolent forces in the world. So cosmic evil is activated by human evil, which in the Zohar's creation myth originates from justice not being tempered by mercy. Evil emerges as creation unfolds. It wasn't necessary that there be evil in this creation myth, in this theodicy, in this explanation of evil, but it was precipitated by human disobedience. And every act of disobedience to God's will empowers those metaphysical forces arrayed against us. We bring on evil ourselves, and there's this parasitic synergy that serves to make our punishments disproportionate to our deeds. That's what we see in the Zohar in 13th century Spain. Now let's talk about the next major development of Jewish mysticism in the land of Israel, in this gorgeous mountain community called Svat or Safed, as it is usually translated in English. The author of this mythical worldview is Isaac Luria, the Holy Lion, Ari HaKodesh. And he describes a very different process of creation and of the origins of evil. The first scene in Isaac Luria's drama of creation is one of tsimtsum, or divine withdrawal. Abraham Joshua Heschel translates this as divine self-restraint. Luria understands that the entire universe, I shouldn't really be talking about space, but let's say all is filled with God. Everything is divine. So in order for God to create something which is not divine, God needs to withdraw or pull back into this space, and then into that vacuum, God can then send in divine energy in order to create the material world. So the first act of creation, and indeed according to Isaac Luria, the first act of every creation, every creative act begins with pulling back, with holding back, with self-restraint. Before you can put something out into the world, you need to hold yourself back. Right? It's an interesting idea about the creative process. So tsimtsum begins this process, but just like pouring oil out of a jug leaves a thin residue of oil on the surface of the inside, when God withdrew from that vacuum, it wasn't a total vacuum. There was a kind of divine residue in that space. And in that residue were the roots of the demonic. They were the dregs, the roots of the demonic. So that when God sent back in divine energy in the form of vessels that were supposed to contain that divine energy, The balance and the symmetry of those divine vessels was upset by the existence of these shards or these roots of the demonic, and the vessels shattered. The vessels shattered. And it is our job in the world to repair the vessels. And in Hebrew, the way to explain that process of repair is tikkun. There's a liberal Jewish magazine called Tikkun, and on the back cover it says to heal, mend, repair the world. Well, originally, in Lurianic Kabbalah, the idea of tikkun wasn't to heal, mend, or repair the world, but it was to heal, mend, and repair those shattered vessels that now, in the mythological explanation, when Jews engage in the commandments, what they're doing is helping to pick up those shards of glass and to restore those vessels. And of course, every transgression that Jews engage in, right, further disintegrate those vessels, and they undo the work that had been done in trying to restore cosmic and divine harmony. And then, of course, the messianic culmination is when everyone succeeds in completely restoring those shattered vessels. Now, if we go back to the Bible's account of creation, you'll remember that I said the Bible has a kind of Platonic understanding of the nature of creation, so that when the curtain opens up on creation, there's already this kind of swirling mass of things on stage. So it could be that that swirling mass, that tohu vavohu in Hebrew, chaos and confusion, wild and waste, unformed and void, according to the different translations, that could be, Isaac Luria could be explaining how that unformed mass of chaos got there. It's not that it's not divine, it is divine, but it's this kind of demonic dregs from the tzimtzum, from the divine withdrawal, that then God and human beings together in partnership are going to try to impose some order and some harmony on to restore that initial cosmic harmony. For Isaac Luria, unlike for the Zohar, evil is built in to the very structure of the world. There couldn't be creation without these demonic dregs, these demonic elements, this metaphysical evil to already foul up the great recipe, to foul up the cosmos. For the Zohar, evil is parasitic on human actions, but Isaac Luria in the 16th century, after the Spanish exile, after the Jews were exiled from Spain in 1492 as a product of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella's consolidation of Spain on the Iberian Peninsula, they no longer wanted to have a Jewish presence. They had finally gotten rid of the Muslim presence and pushed the Muslims back across the Straits of Gibraltar to North Africa. And similarly, they wanted to have a uniform religious presence of Catholicism within Spain. And so the Jews were exiled. So what Isaac Luria does is has God exiled. God no longer is in the universe. So the political conditions of exile may very well have informed Isaac Luria's understanding both of this myth of tzimtzum, of divine withdrawal or divine exile, and it would have given him a much more recent taste of the reality of evil and suffering than perhaps was the case with Maimonides and the philosophical tradition. I don't want to be too psychobiographical about this, but we do have Isaac Luria writing in the decades after the expulsion from Spain. And so the reality of evil was perhaps so present for him that Luria created a myth that understood evil to be part and parcel of the very creation of the cosmos. We are now going to move from theory to reality. Beginning in 1939, we have a six-year process from 39 to 45 of the Holocaust, or in Hebrew, we describe it as the Shoah. The Shoah means catastrophe. The reason why Jews do not use the term Holocaust is because the word itself means a holy burnt offering to God in order to atone for sins. The term Holocaust itself was coined by Christian theologians to describe the Shoah. Jews do not understand what happened in Nazi Europe between 1939 and 1945 to be any kind of sacrifice to God to atone for sins, although there might be some Jews that wouldn't disagree entirely with that description. But the Hebrew term Shoah means catastrophe, and that's generally the term that is used in the American Jewish community, certainly as well as in Israel, to describe these events that resulted in the death, the systematic death, the systematic murder of 6 million Jews. That was 2 out of every 3 Jews on continental Europe, 1 out of every 3 Jews in the world, and it included roughly 1.5 million children. You can read volumes from histories to biographies about the Holocaust. What I am more interested in doing now than going into the details of the Shoah is to look at certain religious responses to the Shoah. Perhaps the religious responses that have the most continuity with the biblical theodicies that we saw in the last lecture are those by the ultra-Orthodox. We'll talk about the ultra-Orthodox in a few lectures, but just to give you a visual image, the ultra-Orthodox today are identifiable because of their black hats and black coats. They wear distinctive clothing to separate them from the rest of the societies in which they lived. They understood that Jews were punished communally for their crimes. And this kind of theodicy has 2 different versions. One crime that this particular group of ultra-Orthodoxy understands the Jews were communally punished for was Zionism. That Zionism arrogated to itself the creation of the State of Israel before the coming of the Messiah. According to this understanding, which in my opinion is not a good reading of rabbinic sources, but according to this understanding, the Messiah should first come and usher in the Messianic era by creating a state of Israel or reestablishing the third Jewish commonwealth. So the Messiah's presence needs to precede the state, according to this reading. I don't think that's an accurate reading of the rabbinic sources, but that's their reading. An interesting biographical note, I am teaching at Vanderbilt University from Nashville, Tennessee, and one rabbi during the Shoah, whose name is Issachar Solomon Teichtel, who had, before World War II, been sympathetic to this ultra-Orthodox group and what their belief system was, and who thought that Zionism was a bad idea, during the war, he comes to write a book called the Em Havanim Smecha, The Joyful Mother of Children, in which he says that he had thought that Zionism was a terrible tragedy, but now we understand that the real tragedy was by not going to Israel, going to Palestine at that time, and supporting the Zionist movement, because the full extent of the Holocaust could never have been possible had there been fewer Jews in Nazi Europe. And so he comes to offer, in the middle of World War II, this ultra-Orthodox rabbi comes to offer a kind of Zionist program and to be sympathetic to the aims of Zionism. His grandson is Yitzhak Teichtel, who is a rabbi in Nashville, Tennessee. He's the rabbi of one of these ultra-Orthodox groups in the Hasidic world called Chabad. So he's our Chabad rabbi. Another understanding of the nature of the sin that caused God to punish the Jews communally with the Holocaust was Reform Judaism. Reform Judaism emerged in Germany, where the Nazi leadership also emerged. And what did Reform Judaism do that was so bad? They rejected the binding authority of Torah and the Halakha. They accepted biblical criticism that God didn't write the Bible, that the Bible's not a product of divine dictation, and that the Halakha is not binding on every Jew. So you do have a relatively minor population, even today within the Jewish world, who understands that the Holocaust was divine punishment for our sins. Another explanation for the Holocaust that goes back to the Bible is that God has hidden his face. And this theodicy also comes in 2 different forms. The first form suggests that since the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans in the year 70, the Jews are in a state of hapless aimlessness as a result of the hiding of God's face. For our exiles, for our sins, we were exiled. And once we were exiled, God hid God's face, and so we are subject to nature, subject to history. We are without divine protection. We are vulnerable. That's one understanding. And as a result of our vulnerability without a state, the Holocaust could happen. The Shoah could happen. Another understanding of the hiding of God's face is that the Shoah was not punitive because the hiding of God's face is constitutional. It's fundamental to who God is. Let me read you a quote from Isaiah 45:15. Isaiah, already in the Bible, says, "You are indeed a God who concealed himself." And so one particular modern Jewish thinker, Eliezer Berkowitz, talks about God as needing to hide God's face in order not to overwhelm us and to interfere with our own free will, which allows for human responsibility. If we're supposed to choose the good and not choose the evil, then we need to have the free will to do that. And God's presence needs to be somehow masked from us. A third explanation or theodicy for the Shoah goes back to not the Bible, but to the rabbinic period. And we find these statements in the Talmud, in the Mishnah in particular. There's a wonderful question that's asked in the Mishnah. Miza gibor, who is mighty? In the Hebrew Bible, a gibor is kind of a macho guy, somebody who's strong and muscular and can defeat people in hand-to-hand combat on the field of battle. So that's what a reader in the rabbinic period who's familiar with the Bible would immediately think. Who's somebody that's strong? Somebody that can bench press 220. That's strong. But the rabbinic answer is one who exercises self-restraint, one who is in control of their emotions and their passions, not one who has eliminated them. We need to have our emotions, we need to have our passions, but we can't let them get the best of us. And so who is the mightiest? God. God is omnipotent, the rabbis would certainly say. And how do we know God's omnipotent? Because God can control God's own anger. And so even though God wanted to lash out at the Romans for persecuting the Jews and destroying the temple, God demonstrated that divine self-restraint by not doing that. You really see here how changes in the politics inform changes in theology. And then those changes in theology changed anthropology. Just like God demonstrates self-restraint, so too should we demonstrate self-restraint so that we can imitate God. Imitatio Dei. Now, there are conceptual parallels between this rabbinic notion of divine self-restraint and the Lurianic notion of divine withdrawal, tsimtsum, or divine self-restraint. Both insist on God's presence and suffering with his creatures, but they lean against divine intervention. Now, another understanding, which is very modern, is that God lacks omnipotence. In this idea of divine self-restraint, God doesn't lack omnipotence. God just demonstrates self-restraint. But in the modern period, there have been Jews that have said, no, we can no longer hold on to the idea that God is all good and all powerful in the face of such evil. We have to give up the idea that God is all powerful. God is still all good, right? But God needs our help. And the work of God is accomplished today through human hands. Now, what's new in this post-Shoah theodicy is the abandonment of mythological language to describe God's lack of omnipotence. Because I think that this idea of divine self-restraint that the rabbis offered, or even Isaac Luria's tsimtsum, divine self-withdrawal, functionally, it means the same thing, that God is incapable of intervening, which is exactly what bothers so many people about the nature of the Shoah. Where was God? Well, God was right here. God was with us. God was suffering with us, but nevertheless, God was incapable of intervening. So I think what's new in this modern period is a demythologization, taking the mythical language out of the Kabbalah, and a democratization of divine service. It's no longer just the male Jewish mystics with the proper intention who can help God in divine service, but everyone can do God's work. Of course, there's another response to the Holocaust, to the Shoah, but that's not new. To say that God is dead, that there is no God. Atheism is not such a new response, nor is it particularly religious. This emphasis in the modern period on what the individual can do, on the power that we can give to enhance God's own power, moves us into modernity and the whole Enlightenment's project of emphasizing the worth of the individual and the unlimited road of progress. So this is an appropriate segue for us to move into the discussion of Jews and modernity.